Despite the hostility directed toward immigrants in recent years, many Americans believe immigrants are good for the country. Ernesto Castaneda is the director of the Immigration Lab and the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University in Washington, D.C. One of his latest books is Immigration and City Vitality, How Newcomers Make Cities Strong. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about how immigrants impact our cities.
Why are immigrants good for cities? We hear all sorts of things about how they're criminals and how they're taking jobs away from people, even though there's not so much evidence of that. Why do you think they're good for American cities?
Yes, indeed, David. The research overwhelmingly shows that they are a very positive thing for cities. That may be hard for the audience to believe because they have heard so many things for so many years to the contrary. Then maybe let's start by trying to explain why people may think it's the other way around. And one thing that I have observed as a sociologist is that people tend to be comfortable with what they know, and they are a little bit allergic to change, especially when the change is negative. So when you get a promotion, when you buy a new house, when there's a new park or new renovations done to public works close to where you live, you may see it as a good thing, and then soon enough you'll get used to it and you will see it as nothing happened, and then it will be taken as a new normal. So that positive change would likely be seen as taken for granted and appreciated. And then there's some other change in cities that is seen as negative, right? When clearly the crime rates go up, when homicide rates go up, when there's a lot of boarded houses, when there's a lot of empty housing, when trash doesn't get picked up, it's evident when that wasn't the case before and then it starts being the case. People can see the change as negative and feel bad about it and then ask officials to do something about it. But then we have something in between that is what causes a lot of noise. Sometimes there are changes that are visible, but that people don't know if they're positive or negative. And then it's easy for politicians or for anecdotes or one-off experiences to get generalized. So I'm talking here when you see in a neighborhood, when it wasn't the case, numbers of people speaking a foreign language in the local grocery store, in a restaurant, when there's people dressed in a different way, where people may have dressing that show they are a different religion than the one you may have or that was the majority in the neighborhood. And then people then may go to these places of, oh, they're going to take over. They are going to, if they're talking another language, they're saying something negative about me. Or they're going to make the prices of the housing go up or go down. So that's where a lot of stress, a lot of pressure goes to those changes that people are nervous about because they don't know which way they are going to go. But so it's understandable for a voter, for a resident to have that anxiety or that question mark. But what as academics, as analysts, we can see over long periods of time, over a lot of cases, is that cities are like living organisms, right? They need to be in constant growth and innovation and change, or they die. They get older and less attractive. And we have seen that, unfortunately, in the United States with the cities that used to be, that are now called the Rust Belt, the cities that were very important during the industrialization period of the U.S.
That's the flight of capital, right?
Yes. Yeah, so you had the flight of capital, but also the flight of people, right? The white flight that many central cities experience when then you have more people of color living in the inner city, and that was seen as a dangerous place, partly because it was impoverished people. And as you say, the capital, the jobs, the opportunities left, there was very little for people to figure out. And even if you have black majors, there was not a lot of a tax base or a lot of resources to use. And then when people come back into Harlem, into Brooklyn, into Baltimore, into Detroit, and then it's called gentrification, and producing an increase in the quality of living. So these are kind of the extremes of this dynamic, but they just to simplify that when cities lose population, particularly in working class, middle class, businesses, there's a decrease in the quality of life. But when it loses population in general, it's bad for cities. So to answer your question, when cities gain population, it's the best of the alternatives. Yes, if there's more population, there's going to be more traffic. There's going to be more density. It may take a little longer to get to where you want to be because the city may be expanding. There will be more difference in all senses in the cities. But that's what makes cities rich culturally, cool in terms of the cuisines, in terms of the innovation. So people are good for cities. Cities grow and thrive because of newcomers. A lot of the people are coming from other parts of the U.S., but nowadays people that don't finish high school in the U.S. were at the lowest time in our history of people moving from the East Coast and going west, going to California. That was a big story. That's how California grew in population. That is not the case now. It's more common for people to leave California, go to more affordable places. But half of the population, most people than ever, are not moving from the counties where they were born. What I'm trying to say is that in order for cities, states, towns to keep growing, that has been happening in the last, particularly the last decade, thanks to international migrants. That's why they are so important.
The attitude that you talked about, where people are afraid of change, of new people coming in, that's age old, right? That goes back to the early United States, for example, when I don't know, that influx of from Europe, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, all the Southern Europeans. And if you read newspapers back then, you could see the commentaries about the criminal element, and people distrusted them, and there was even attempts and successful attempts to deport people, right?
Absolutely. All these groups face that. It's not something new. And indeed, a large number of Irish arrive after the Irish famine that England precipitated. A lot of Irish people arrive in New York City to the degree that at one point there were between 40 or 50% of the residents of Manhattan were Irish-born, first-generation immigrants. So yeah, there was a visible big change. There was a lot of Gaelic spoken in the streets. There were a lot of Irish people. Some of the Irish people had problems with alcoholism. Some of them were paupers. Some of them were very poor. Some of them came as unaccompanied minors. They were 14-year-old single and had to work to make ends meet. Some of them will do petty crime. But the bulk of the Irish and other groups that arrived in New York early on, they were working. They started new businesses. They were doing trades. They will eventually become firefighters and policemen. And nowadays, they're part of the fabric and the mainstream of what America is today. They are part of whiteness, right? Same with Italian Americans, same with Eastern Europeans, same with Jews. It's a story that we have successfully overcome. And these groups have made America what it is today. But funny enough, with new groups from Asia, from Latin America that we see today, we pretend like the US, some people in some cities forget that history and pretend that it has never happened before. But yeah, if you look at San Francisco, there's been many waves of immigrants. And some of them were banished. The Chinese were indeed excluded from California for a long time. And then they came in large numbers. Central Americans came to San Francisco in the 80s in large numbers. But now there are not that many more Salvadorians that are leaving and arriving into California these days, or Guatemalans. The ones that had to move, they moved. Same with the Vietnamese that arrived after the end of the war. They established themselves in the coast. Vietnam is doing great today. So there's going to be other groups coming. So it's an evergreen story. It keeps happening in the US and in other countries, but it's still the people in the streets keep getting surprised. And they keep relearning these lessons. But for the city, again, to have newcomers is good news, because that means that they are going to have kids going to schools. You don't have to close your local schools. There's going to be people in working age that are going to be contributed to most of America is aging. So we need people to contribute to Social Security, to pay taxes, so that the people can retire, can have access to healthcare. One of the biggest industries today, David, in the US is the healthcare sector. And who is doing a lot of the care, who is doing a lot of the nursing, who are a lot of the doctors? Foreign-born people that are coming here as legal migrants. So we need that inflow of people. What is happening today, 2026, with Donald Trump, is that it's harder than ever for anybody, professionals, non-professionals, with permission, without permission, refugees or safety or South African. It's very hard for anybody to come into the US. We're seeing a negative migration, and we're seeing some Americans leaving the US. So the population is starting to decrease in population in the US. We have not seen that since the establishment of the 13 colonies. It's been a story of expansion, of, yes, slavery and the killing of the natives, but otherwise, people from other parts of the world creating what America is today. So we cannot reproduce that story, but we can keep at least growing 2-3% population-wise, and have our economy keep growing like that. That's the system that we have. Without people, the economy can grow. So that's why we have a lot of inflation. We can talk more about that, But the fact that there's no workers is very hard for businesses to hire people. And we're talking about restaurants, we're talking about construction, small businesses, and obviously big corporations. So then it's harder for professionals to get jobs once they graduate from college because there's not the normal amount of new people for the economy to keep growing. So again, where you see this most obviously is in the cities.
So how do you get people to realize, actually a substantial part of the population already does realize that immigrants are good. How do you break through and make people understand what you're talking about, that there's a richness to new people coming in that makes cities thrive?
Yes, that's right. People know this also intuitively and personally, right? Many Americans are married to a foreign-born person. Many of them have adopted a child from abroad. Many of them may have a neighbor or a coworker who is coming from another part of the world or whose parents were immigrants. Many of us have grandparents that one of them was born abroad. So there's always these personal relationships that is people that we trust, that we know, that we like, or that we dislike, but like we dislike in many other people in different ways for different reasons. So people know that, but then one of the problems when the political discourse is anti-immigrant is that then people may say, oh yeah, but Rosa or Maria or that guy is an exception. They are not like people from that country. And that's so that's that makes the person keep that good opinion of the persons they know that are foreign born or immigrants. But then say, well, no, if they're saying that the border is out of control, or if they are saying that immigrants commit crime, well, yeah, there's bad criminals and we don't want them. So much so that even some immigrants bought into that account in the last elections and even voted for Trump saying, yeah, he's not going to deport me because I'm a good person. He's going to go for the, they are indeed some immigrants who commit crime. He's going to take care of them. But the problem with these discourses is that they generalize and they say all Mexicans, all Salvadorians, or all Haitians are bad, are how eat dogs and cats, and all these stereotypes that some people may believe if they keep hearing them. So, but now with the mass deportations that we have seen and the multiple stories in the media of teachers, of children, of nurses, people that were in the military, spouses of military that are being detained and deported without any criminal records. I think people that maybe have bought into this idea that some of the immigrants were a problem or were criminals, that maybe that claim was exaggerated. And again, the research shows that the crime rates among the immigrants are much lower than for the US born. But it doesn't mean that all immigrants are saints or that immigrants commit zero crime. They commit some crime. So then when Laken Riley, unfortunately, was killed by an immigrant, then you hear that story in Fox News nonstop and in other media. And then people, they get stuck in their mind. But I think also it's getting across that the crime rates, the probability that somebody that came here, especially if they're undocumented, they don't want to get in trouble. They don't want to get deported. They need to work here. They need to send money back home, or they need to support their family here. So they are very law-abiding people. They don't want to be go to prison. It's very costly in so many senses. They are doing this for the future of their children, of their great children, great grandchildren. So they're gonna follow the law the most time. So how do we change this opinion? That's why we wrote the book. It's for a big audience. It goes into history, it goes into different case studies. It shows the evidence, but in a very readable fashion without being too dry or too boring, going to different time periods and places, giving a lot of concrete examples. And again, I think people today are very open to learn more about immigration, to change their views. Not as likely to hear what some anti-immigrant think tanks and politicians have been saying for a while. So I think they can believe more their own eyes and when they see all the positive effects that they have, because most people in the Bay Area and in many big cities in the US, they love to go to a Thai restaurant, to an Indian restaurant, to a Mexican restaurant. It's part of like high quality of life in the US today. It's not the same everywhere. In France, for example, still a lot of the French middle class, they don't want to go to the African restaurant that the immigrants open down the street. There's still a differentiation there. But in America, people are very good at trying and adopting and enjoying other cuisines, music, etc. So we just have to continue that tradition and not problematize it, and the opposite, celebrate it, because indeed it benefits everyone.
Now, there has been a problem historically at times with labor unions where there was a resentment against immigrants taking jobs, for example, when people went on strike. Is that an issue at all now, or is that kind of gone?
Historically, that is the case, and early on in the industrial times, sometimes there will be, yes, Irish or Polish immigrants that will be brought to cross the picket lines and break a strike with the Puerto Rican or African American workers in Detroit, for example. So that there were some instances of that. So historically, it happened, and for a long time, AFL-CIO and other big unions had this policy that they were against undocumented immigration because it was a disloyal competition with U.S. Born workers and union members. But that changes with the immigration reforms signed into law by Reagan in the mid-80s, where the unions were part of that arrangement. It was the church, academia, government, the two parties, the people hiring the workers, and the unions that came to an agreement that it was worth it for everybody to provide an amnesty. It was a way to improve everybody's working rights. And since then, in the 90s, but especially since the 2000s, the leaders of the unions, they know that, as you know, union membership has declined. So one way for the union members to stay stable or to grow is to incorporate in their ranks immigrant workers, cleaning offices, hotels, restaurants, etc. That's been a very active in California and in other places. Some of the most active unionizing and campaigns for labor rights have been with immigrant workers. So I
Oh,
think
like the
today,
SEIU, yeah, the janitor's campaign, yeah.
So I think that's the new understanding that if there's workers that have less rights, it's bad for all the workers. But if all the by law, even if somebody's undocumented, they have the same labor rights as somebody else. Sometimes they don't know it, and the employer is going to try to abuse them. But and that's again why regularizing people is better. But in terms of unionizing, when you unionize the whole working force, the unions become stronger and they can make better claims vis-a-vis their employers. So I think most labor leaders understand that. Now, in terms of whether immigrants take away jobs from the native, again, there's the experience. So you, a young person or anybody, may have applied for a job. You know, somebody wanted to work in a grocery, they didn't get the job, and then they see that a person of color or a foreign-born person got it, and they may be upset, and that happened to them. But what the research shows is that overall, the more immigrants, the more people in a city, the more jobs. Because yes, a Latino person may come into California, into the Bay Area, and start working in construction and maybe displace a white worker that was working in construction. But what's going to happen? That white worker can start a small business and hire that labor, and they can benefit from that. Or they can start selling the tools or the materials, or they can supervise a larger construction operation. And that happens with African Americans because they know the US culture, they speak English, they have better jobs that they would have if it wasn't for new people coming from Africa, Asia, Latin America today. So it wasn't the case early on, it wasn't the case in the cities early on, but now the sample evidence showing that. And why? Because an immigrant is not only a labor force, yes, most of them are coming here to work, but they also need to get a haircut, they need to eat, they need to get transportation, they need to send their kids to school. So they're creating jobs for the other people in the cities. Many places in the US, if it wasn't for immigrants, the teachers will have no jobs. The schools will close. There'll be less nurses. There will be less hospitals, less firefighters, less police to control a city. So immigrants also, most of the work that they do in the US, they may send a little portion of their salary, 15%, if they have family members abroad, but the rest is going to be spent in the US in services and goods and rent that they're paying to the landlord that is benefiting from that. And also, who is building construction in the US today? Who's producing food very cheaply? Immigrant labor. So they are also subsidizing the livelihoods and the housing and the food consumption of everybody else in the city and the country. So immigrants are not only a source of labor, but because they are people like everybody else and they consume, they buy things, they create jobs for other people that are not immigrants.
Did you happen to hear the vice president's statement the other day about how women should have more babies? Do you think he was motivated by this idea that the country needs more people to fill the needs, the jobs, so that we don't need immigrants?
Yes. I mean, funny enough, a lot of people around the world are worried because Japan has been aging for a while. Population-wise, the population is declining, and the economy is not as strong as it would be because of that. China, even with the one-child policy and all that, it's still huge in terms of population, but it's decreasing. It's stopping to grow. Most Latin America is aging faster than the US, Europe, obviously. So we get a few exceptions of South Asia and some places in Africa that are still have a lot of children, have a lot of young populations. Most of the world population is not this scale that was going to become exponential, it's going to become so big that the planet couldn't hold it. There's important environmental issues to discuss, but that can be done through policy, etc. But it's not the population bomb that many people fear for many years. Now it's the opposite. Now people are scared about their countries disappearing because there are not enough babies. Unfortunately, and there's a policy concern in terms of contribution to retirement accounts, in terms of city growth, and that is real, and that's why planners and all that are worried about it. But unfortunately, a lot of people in the extreme right, eugenicists and racist and other people, are afraid of there not being enough white French people, because then they're afraid that white population is going to decrease, that it's going to be overtaken by people from Africa, from the Middle East, with different religions, and that the white French population, even though they don't use the term white, but yeah, the white French population is going to be overtaken from people coming from the immigration. So that's where the great replacement theory comes from, the French example, which I've done research in France, and there's the white people are still in the majority. They have control of institutions. They have much more problems of segregation and exclusion that we have in the US, which are bad for them. But even though they're having less babies, they're still in the majority, and you just need a replacement. So if a couple has two children, then it's going to be very stable. And that's where most countries are. Just the thing is that women are having better jobs, better pay. They're having children later. So sometimes the numbers may take a little while to show, but most people still are having at least one kid or two. So it's not. And the other thing is a lot of immigrants, they become white, so they act like white. And they're not replacing their culture for the local culture. They're contributing things and cultural things, but they're also reproducing the local cultures. So an example I like to give in the French context is that there was a contest of the best traditional baguettes in Paris. And the bakeries that have been winning in the latest years, there was a story in the New York Times a few months ago, is people that were born abroad in Asia, in Africa, and now they are expert traditional baguette makers in Paris. Or if you want to buy a crepe in a touristy part of Paris, it's going to be an immigrant that is selling it to you. And it's the same in the US, right? You go to Chicago for a deep dish pizza, it's going to be Latinos making the pizzas, not Italian Americans anymore, right? And who's making the, who's flipping the burgers? It's people from all over the world. It's not white Americans or Germans. It's not that anymore, but the American culture continues and it's exported around the world and it's very healthy. So this great replacement culturally is false. There's always cultural change, but it's not a replacement. And population-wise, people like Vance, they want to have more white, conservative, Christian. So that's why they're white Christian nationalists. They want more people like themselves with their religious beliefs to be the majority in numbers and to be on the top in terms of power and privileges and hierarchy. So therefore, for them, it's very important to have these trad wives, these traditional wives that stay home, because then they can care for more children. Otherwise, it's very expensive in the US. As you know, it's very expensive to put a few kids in daycare. So a lot of families, it's not that they don't want to have more kids, it's that they cannot afford to have more than two kids. There were numbers that the latest numbers from this year is that it cost an average American family, it's going to depend where, but it cost around $30,000 to raise a child from baby to high school. Then if we talk about college, it's much more money. So you have to make a lot of money to afford more than two children. So if you are Vance, that you're a lawyer from Yale and your wife is two, and some of the people that have the luxury to have the stay-home moms taking care of five children, like Hex said, then you can do that. But for the working class, for immigrants, that is hard. Even immigrants from countries that they have higher fertility rates, after living in the US, they're gonna be very similar to the fertility rates of the locals. So even though early on Mexican immigrants used to have more children, today that's less the case. And their children are gonna have the same number of children as American families, partly because this is limited by the wages and the lack of healthcare support, daycare support that the US family has. So if Vance was really worried about family values and supported larger families, the state will be the way to do it. More daycares, more kindergartens, cheaper, better public housing, public spaces, etc. But unfortunately, the evidence shows that they want particular kind of children, so we don't have to depend on immigrants. And Miller says this very openly. No, we know the population is shrinking. We know that, but we better take that have more immigrants. And instead of that, we want white people to have more children, and they're actively trying to convince a lot of people, particularly in the South, in rural areas where it's less expensive, to have these children. And it's become a cultural thing that is very, very visible on social media, but still, how many people are actually able to do that is not enough to reverse these demographic trends. And a little Trump account when the babies are born, or a little incentive in taxes, European examples show that those things don't change, they're not enough to change the fertility rates and the number of children that the local families are having.
The Germans under Hitler, the duty of women was to have children for the Reich.
Yes, but mandated by the state. That was, again, a very clear eugenic mandate for particular types of Germans, not for all of them. So, yeah, no, this the history of these policies is very dark.
And some people are worried about a kind of handmaid's tale society emerging in the U.S.
Yeah, and it's not exaggerated because some for Miller, for Hegseth, for Vance, this is very, they say it like very explicitly. They have said that publicly. So it's not a conspiracy theory. They wish this to happen. But again, even if they're in positions of power, even if they really believe in this, for this to become a reality that really changes the demographics of the U.S. is much harder to do. It takes much more time and effort and convincing. I don't think most American women are buying into this.
That's American University professor Ernesto Castaneda speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on June 15th, 2026.